Welcome to this episode of the Pastor's Call podcast. I'm your host, Joel Webb. Before we begin today's episode, I want to thank the sponsor for the show. It's Blue Water Free Methodist Church, where I have the pleasure of serving. We're an intentional community reflecting Jesus to our world. I also want to thank Refresh Digital Services, who produces and publishes this podcast. Well, today I'm so excited to have joining me literally from the other side of the planet on an inverse time zone, Emily Payne. She is the vicar in the Anglican parish of Northern Albury in Australia. Thank you so much for joining me, Emily.
It's a pleasure. It's lovely to be here.
Well, let's get right into it. I'd love for you to share a little bit about who you are, your background, and what you felt your call into the pastoral ministry was.
The background thing is always interesting. It's like, where do I start and how long do I go on for? But a couple of things that might be worth mentioning. So I'm originally from Cape Town. Your listeners can't see me, so I'll clarify that I was a white South African. But my parents, after some interesting situations, said, this is not where we want to raise our family. This was still very much apartheid era. So they came to Australia. So I've got that migrant experience of always being sort of a little bit outside the culture I'm working in, which is actually really good practice for being in the church. In terms of Christian identity, my parents were very, very lapsed Catholics, didn't take us to church growing up. Mum taught me to pray and taught me to read and believe my Bible, but it was very much this individual thing that you did with God. So it wasn't until I was a young adult that I started saying, well, this is fine, but I think maybe there's more than this. Mm. And looking around to see what that more might be and what it might look like, and eventually figuring out that, oh, we do this thing with other people and we call it church. And actually there are lots of really good things about that. Is that a helpful start?
Yeah. And so from that point, you know, discovering and coming into your faith and discovering the church, what did that look like moving forward, kind of discovering or feeling your call to then, oh, like I feel the Lord calling me to actually participate and lead in the church?
In hindsight, I think the call was there long before I recognized it. I had this impulse to do something that would help other people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you're growing up unchurched and you're not, I mean, how do you recognize a vocation to ministry when you don't see ministry? Mm-hmm. And in the 90s in Australia, people were not talking to young girls discerning their career about going into church leadership. So what I actually did first was a science degree. Mm. I had this idea that, you know, the health sciences were the place where I could help people. And that was really interesting and good learning, but I did my degree and I ended up working for a big pharmaceutical company, and it didn't take me long to realize that was mostly about making money for shareholders, not actually mostly about helping people. So for me, there was quite a period of, well, is this what I'm going to spend 30, 40, 50 years of my working life doing? Is this it? Is this what God wants me to do with my life? Is this what I'm gifted for? And eventually I got very fed up and very frustrated with all of it, and had quite a tense conversation with God where I kind of went, well, here's everything I am. It's all on the table. You know my weaknesses. You know my strengths better than I do. You tell me where I'm supposed to be. Just, you know, you tell me and I'll go. Don't ask that if you don't really want the answer. But out of that, I really was, for the first time, you know, it's the brick to the head moment, able to see that God was saying, well, actually, come and serve me in a ministry kind of way. And even then, I didn't necessarily know exactly what that would be. There are different forms of ministry. My dad was a prison warden, so I really for a while I thought I'd be a prison chaplain. Took me a while to work out that was not my thing. but I think part of discerning your vocation, I mean, it's one thing to say I'm called to ministry, but working out where in ministry and what kind of role in ministry, some of that is a bit of give things a go and see what works and see what doesn't, and see what brings you alive and see where your strengths shine. And for me, I worked out that I'm actually quite good at congregational ministry, in a way that I'm not particularly good at chaplaincy. So, well, put it this way, the mix of my strengths doesn't shine in chaplaincy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So from that point now of realizing and coming, you know, this is where I feel God's calling. Where do you start? What does that process look like? You know, I've had the opportunity, as we talked a little bit before, had a couple Anglicans on and, you know, talked to numerous denominations, and it's always fascinating hearing the differences in process. So what did that look like for you?
And Anglicans are fun because it's different everywhere in the world and different from diocese to diocese. In Anglicanism, a diocese is the area under the oversight of the bishop. So I trained in the Diocese of Melbourne, and they had, which for your listeners is a city on the southeast coast of Melbourne, about 4 hours from where I am now. And so they had a program they called a Year of Discernment. And if you felt a vocation to ministry, and at first blush, there was no reason to say, no, really, just no, that's no, not happening. They'd invite you into this process and you'd spend a year. They'd have, I think it was about 7 sessions that you'd go to with presenters on different topics, on different aspects of ministry. And in between, you'd be encouraged to be meeting with a mentor and to be doing some reading and to be doing some journaling and just kind of seeing how you and God go through that process and where you get to by the end of it. The way it was explained to me is that before they had put this process in place, they basically would invite you just to front up to an interview panel. And it wasn't really enough time for you or for the interview panel. Whereas by giving people a year and inviting them and assisting them to think and reflect and process and pray, a lot of people for whom the answer was no figured that out for themselves. Rather than having their heart set on feeling that God's calling them to something and wanting wholeheartedly to offer for that and having to hear a very abrupt no from the church. And I went through this process, and at the end of it, I still wasn't 100% sure, because in the Anglican Church you can be in ministry as a layperson, as a deacon or as a priest. And I really wasn't sure which one of those things was right. I felt quite strongly drawn to being a deacon. But where I was, it was made very clear to me not to expect a paying job as a deacon. We like deacons. We like deacons who work for nothing, or who find other ways to support their ministry. Well, that's nice if you have the means to do that. It's more problematic if you don't. So what I ended up doing, I ended up ticking the box on the form that said priest and said stipendary, which means I want to be paid, please, and saying to God, if this is not where you want me, don't open the door. And the doors just kept opening. So I figure God worked it out. It sounds silly when I say it like that, but at the time it was a very real, I'm not quite sure, but I can't afford to do this full time and not have a job.
Yeah. So what did your schooling preparation process and everything kind of leading up to ordination then look like for you, and what was that experience like?
So I'd come in with a Bachelor of Science, which is fun but completely unrelated to ministry. So the academic program for me was a Master of Divinity and a Diploma of Ministry, which we kind of basically that you needed to do too many things to fit just into the masters. So the overflow units, they sat in a diploma so that you got some award for all the work you do. Normally that would be a 4-year program, but my daughter was born in the middle of it, so I took 6 years. And that was, I don't regret that. It gave me a very rich time. For 5 of those years, I had field placements. I was working casually for a church at the same time. So I had a very rich formation, not just what I was learning in the classroom, but various forms of real life experience, as well as becoming a mum. So that by the time I got to the end of my process, and I'm 10 years on from it now, I'm really grateful I had a really strong, solid formation. Because I'm not sure that a classroom alone can do it for you.
No, yeah, and maybe talk about some of the dynamics, because you're directly interacting with what you're learning in school and then actually like, hey, this is actually what's happening in ministry, dealing, like, it can sound great in theory, but once you deal with people, it's out the window. You know, what, how was some of that at play that you kind of maybe perceived during your time of schooling?
I think it, when you're in, and I don't know what seminary programs in America are like, but when you're in the kind of seminary program I went through, there's a really strong focus on things like learning your biblical languages. In my case, Greek. I didn't do Hebrew, thank goodness. Thank goodness that wasn't compulsory. But, you know, an awful lot of intensely academic study of the Bible and of theology and all that. And I don't want to say that's bad or wrong, because it's not. But it doesn't necessarily equip you for how do I take what I'm learning here and communicate that. So, for example, my congregation here, they are incredibly beautiful, godly people. A lot of them never finished school. They're not. If I tried to communicate to them the way I write an academic paper, what I'm saying is going to be lost. And that's not because they're stupid, but it's because the life experience they bring to hearing a sermon or sitting in a Bible study is completely different. So learning how to meet people where they are, how to listen for what's going on for them, and then how to build the connections with what the academic stuff is packed in your toolkit is a whole other art form, and you don't learn that in a classroom.
Yeah, that process is important. Just because, yeah, you don't want to be just speaking to air.
No. Yeah. And you could give the most academically accomplished sermon, but if it's not offering people any hope, any encouragement, any joy, any grace, you might as well not bother.
Yeah. So what? So then, from that seminary point, now you're moving on. What does that kind of final ordination process, the final countdown to that, and what was your first appointment like after that?
So, Anglicans, if you become a priest in the Anglican Church, you're made a deacon first. So for us, we have what we call exit interviews from college. And that's, is this person ready to be made a deacon? And some of those interviews were actually a bit tricky, because at that point my daughter was about to turn two. And the things that the panel struggled with for me were things like, how are you going to manage your family life? How are you going to manage the things that sustain you as a person in ministry when you're trying to care for a toddler? How are you, and my husband only recently became an Anglican. Most of our marriage, he's worshipped in another denomination, in another church. And we never had any problem with that. But some of the people looking at our marriage went, is that going to help you, or is it going to undermine you? So in the end, I must have either looked very stubborn or come across as more mature perhaps than I was, but they let me go through. So you serve, you're made a deacon in the February and a priest in the November, in the diocese I was ordained in, if all goes well. So the most of your first year of ministry, it's very explicitly a training position. You're put in as an assistant in a parish with someone senior and accomplished to mentor and supervise you. I was fortunate to have an excellent person supervising me who really took the part of that that was about equipping me very seriously and went out of his way to give me opportunities and to make sure that I, because sometimes what happens is the training supervising priest goes, great, you're here to do all the grunt work I don't want to do. But he didn't, I mean, there's a bit of that, but he didn't treat me just as the person to pick up the jobs he didn't want to do. He was very intentional about making sure I got a chance to take funerals, to take weddings, to baptize, to take different kinds of services, to be involved in different things so that when I left, I could be well equipped. And that was, I'm so grateful to him for a really good experience.
And so from now that kind of deacon experience to ordination to where you are today, kind of give us the 30,000 foot overview, maybe with a couple of the high points and low points, just kind of highlighting some of those kind of forming experiences through those times.
So I've been ordained 10 years now. So the first couple of years were that first training appointment. And then I was approached to be the assistant priest through a process of two churches amalgamating. So there was a senior priest who was going to look after this process, and I was invited to come in and be the assistant. And I thought, that's what a great opportunity to learn about change and how church communities navigate big change and all that. So I said yes, and I got there, and then they refused to amalgamate. So I spent 18 months in there, hanging in there going, Lord, what am I doing here? Like, literally, what are you doing here? What am I supposed to be doing here apart from caring for these people through a very difficult time? And after that, I think the bishop felt maybe I needed rescuing, because I've since then had two sort of 3-year stints running a parish in my own right. Coming up here, so I'm now in the Diocese of Wangaratta, and coming up here was a COVID move. The Diocese of Melbourne was in severe lockdown for months and months and months on end, and my position there was coming to an end, and it was, everyone agreed it was right that I move on. I'd done what I could do there, but there were no jobs in Melbourne because everyone was in lockdown. So I've actually just crossed a state border and come up to a parish that was not in lockdown so that I could have a ministry position. It's, God works in very mysterious ways.
And I'm sure the ministry is similar across dioceses, but what does that average week look like kind of in that parish setting? Because that is different for a lot of, especially people in a Western American context, you know, we kind of have the highway church where people kind of drive in, do church, do their things, and then leave. But what does that kind of daily week-to-week ministry look like for you in your parish setting?
It looks very different everywhere. So the parish I'm in now my main church is in a reasonable sized country town. But we are very much in a rural area. So I look after four churches, as in four piles of bricks and mortar with congregations in them, are all part of one parish.
Okay.
So I'm on the road a bit.
And
the difficult thing about that in ministry terms is not actually the time spent traveling or whatever, but it's that my community is fragmented. I never get them all in the room at the same time. Communication is much more difficult. Instead of being able to say things, you know, normally in a congregation, by the time you said things three times, most people have heard it. By the time I've said something three times, I haven't even spoken to everyone once.
Yeah.
And we have to work much more intentionally at building the bonds of how a team works together to lead, like the lay people as well, to lead this parish, because they don't even organically see one another. The other big thing in this parish is we run a food bank 3 mornings a week. And so that is great in terms of serving our local community and bringing people who might otherwise not have anything to do with the church into contact with us as a church community, and positive contact where we're serving them. And we actually, the food bank is physically located at the back of the church. So they come in for food, but they come into a worship space. And some of them will come in and sit and pray as well as take, and all of that. And we, so we it's great for building connections and helping people feel safe with the church and all of that sort of stuff. But it is an enormous amount of work. So that dominates here in a way that, say, in my previous parish, just wasn't a thing. The other big thing here, so there's an Anglican school in the parish, which is really lovely, and they haven't been able to get a chaplain for the last 2 years, so I get drafted in to do a fair bit of support for their chapel program, which is, again, it's really lovely, but I've already got a full-time job. And I am not trained to work in schools. I've never worked in a school before. I'm not a teacher. So that's been a very steep learning curve.
So what's the physical distance between the four, piles of bricks and wood, just to give some scale to that travel for you?
I'm fortunate in that mine are actually reasonably close together. I could drive a circuit around them in a bit over an hour. So that's not too bad. Some of my colleagues drive an hour from one centre to another, and they look after multiple places. But mine are, for stupid historical reasons, we built cl churches much closer together when everyone had to get to them by horse and cart. And then we love our pile of bricks and mortar so much that we can't possibly let it go. This might just be an Anglican thing, I don't know, but it's so mine are not too far apart, but it's more the fragmentation of the community than the physical distance that is a challenge for me. So I don't, is that a help?
No, appreciate the insights and thoughts on that. One thing I wanted to kind of ask about, understanding, the Anglican Church certainly is much more liturgical than what we see in other elements and parts of the church. So what have you found that you've just really loved and appreciated about practicing a more liturgical faith in our kind of fast-paced contemporary world? Because this is a conclusion that I'm coming to. I'm growing up in a background that doesn't have really any liturgy, doesn't do any form of traditional practice of a service. I'm slowly being drawn into appreciating kind of the practice of church from the ancient past or not so ancient past that is much more formulated. And so what do you draw from that, or how do you see that work in your parish community, especially living in such kind of a crazy modern fast-paced world?
I didn't think about that ahead of time, but I wish I had, because I'm probably going to give you much less of a good answer than I might have if I'd had time. I think there are a number of things. One of them, and this might sound silly, but there's a degree of quality control in it. When you have a church that doesn't have as much liturgical structure and there's much more freedom for those leading worship to go where the Spirit takes them. I don't want to be mean about my colleagues in other traditions, but the quality of the product is known to vary a bit. But even on my worst day, in a liturgical tradition, I can fall back on what it says in the book, and I can know that I'm not inadvertently falling into heresy. I'm not giving my people something that is weak or half-baked or untested. Even if I've woken up with a thumping headache and I can't think straight, and the spirit's certainly not getting much looking today, as long as I say the words on the page, we are getting a solid meal liturgically. Now, that's not to say that you can't be creative, and it's great at different opportunities to draw on diverse resources and to really make the most of the richness of what the tradition allows you to do. But it's to say that even on the days when you're doing the equivalent of the quickest, easiest, most straightforward thing, I can have confidence that what people are being offered in worship is pretty sound. Does that make sense?
And we don't have to draw this dichotomy just because it's the same thing that we did last week and it's been the same thing for the last 100 years. you know, it doesn't mean it's not as much spirit breathed as the thing that we popped into our head and discerned was maybe something that the Lord was saying. You know, I that's a false dichotomy to draw. I think that that's not as inspired, or it's not as beneficial for the day as well.
I think so. And I think there's, I mean, there's always this interweaving, because there's the words of the liturgy, and then there are the words of the hymns you choose, or the songs mm-hmm. that you choose. And they're not prescribed in the same way, but they are also drawn out of a rich repository of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And there is your preaching, which has whatever degree of preparation you put into your preaching. And there are your prayers, which might go from very highly scripted to very extempore. And so there's this interweaving of elements. Mm. There's never two services that are identical. Even when I go from one church to another and do exactly the same service again, it doesn't come out the same. The encounter between one another and with God in that place is not a replica. It's unique to the people participating in it. Mm. So no, I think one of the pitfalls of that tradition is it can become easy to be lazy. And to go, well, I don't have to think about it. I don't have to prepare. I don't have to be creative, because, hey, the book is there.
Yeah.
That's not great ministry either. You've got to take the time to think about, how do I make the best use of the options my tradition offers me for these people in this moment, this time.
Mm.
But there is that tension.
Thank you. Appreciate you kind of expounding on that, talking a bit more about the tension of that. You know, it's a reality of both of those things.
I might add, there will be times when you know what the words on the page say, but you also know this is one of those moments where I just have to put this aside for a minute.
Hmm.
Because actually God's doing something really important with us here now.
Hmm.
But I think the art of ministry is knowing when to do that, and when actually, you know, I guess being able to be wise in how you use what you're given.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you so much for that, and I hope I certainly appreciated all of that, and so I hope, you know, someone listening is appreciating that as well. I know that there are those who are. So there's a Charles Spurgeon quote I love. He talks about living in the Bible but reading many good books, and through God's word and the power of the Holy Spirit, you know, our lives have been changed and transformed. But what have been some of those good books for you professionally or just individually over the years?
Well, I picked out two, knowing that you would ask me this question. I picked out two. And I remembered a spiritual director I once heard who said to us that for every new book you read, you should read two old books. So don't fall into the trap of thinking that everything worth reading was written 5 minutes ago.
And that's from a C.S. Lewis quote as well. He talks about, he has a whole, there's a series of published patristic books, and there's a section from C.S. Lewis where he talks about that very thing. So,
well, there you go. I didn't realize he was quoting C.S. Lewis. For the old book, I'm going to recommend, it's actually, the book title is Aelred of Rivaux, Treatises and Pastoral Prayer. I'm recommending it for the pastoral prayer. Don't worry, I'll pop that in chat for you. But his pastoral prayer is, I think he was an abbot, but it's his prayer for himself and his community as he is their pastor. And it's just, particularly when I was newly ordained, I read over it regularly and found it really helpful and really grounding and really life-giving. So Aelred of Rivaux's Pastoral Prayer for you, something old. For you, something new, something completely different. Making Property Serve Mission, Rethinking the Church's Buildings for the 21st Century. Mm. And again, I'll pop that in the notes for you. I'll send it to you. That book is written by a gentleman here who is he is an architect by trade, and he's done a lot of projects helping churches add on to or revamp their buildings. And he realized that so many church leaders, lay and ordained, are poorly equipped to think about how their buildings serve their mission, that he's written a whole book on it. Every church I've served with has needed to read that book. So I recommend it to everyone now.
Those are awesome recommendations. I haven't heard of or read either of those books, so I look forward to getting my hands on them. And you'll send those to me, and then those will be in the show notes. Those will be in the show notes so that everybody can access those and find those and read those stuff. Awesome recommendations. Lovely. Yeah, thank you for recommending those. Well, Emily, thank you so much for taking the time and joining us today on the Pastor's Call podcast. Appreciate you sharing your journey and your ministry.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. I also want to thank the sponsor for the show. It's Blue Water Free Methodist Church. We're an intentional community reflecting Jesus to our world. I also want to thank Refresh Digital Services, who produces and publishes this podcast. And of course, finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for joining us on another episode of the Pastor's Call podcast, where our hope, our goal, and our vision is to encourage those who are interested, pursuing, or in the pastoral ministry by hearing the stories of those who've gone before. You can find this podcast wherever podcasts are found. Also, look for us on Facebook and on YouTube. In the meantime, listen to other episodes, share it with your family and friends, share it with your pastor, and we'll see you in the next episode. God bless.